going for refuge has been an emphasis in Tree Ratna. I mean, if you didn't know before that going for refuge was an emphasis in Tree Ratna, by the time you've read chapter 4 of A New Voice in the Buddhist Tradition, by the time you've read the Buddhist Manifesto, you've got round to reading The History of My Going for Refuge by Sangharakshita, you know now that there's a very strong emphasis on going for refuge in the Tree Ratna community. And I want to try and just give a little bit of a flavour of why. I mean, if you've done your background reading, I'm sure you all have, you're already pretty well versed. You're working off the same sources that I am, but maybe at least I can try and do a little bit of a précis of the material that we've been covering, and just try and say a little bit about why going for refuge is as central as it is. Probably the sort of key text, really, is the history of my going for refuge. And I think it's kind of interesting that we're doing these little life stories around what's been spiritually significant for each of us. On this retreat, we're doing these life stories. I think one of the things that I'm struck by being part of a spiritual community, and it's something that quite a few people have remarked on, is that as people practice more, if anything, they get more distinct. You know, if you look around the room here, it's not that you're looking at a kind of cookie-cutter set of Buddhists. Actually, people, if anything, seem to get a little bit more idiosyncratic than they were when they started. But, you know, like people have their own definite characters, their own definite approaches. And I think the way Viradama framed the prep question, we'll just read it out. What does going for refuge mean to you in personal terms? In terms of your one precious individual life, what are you moving towards? And I think that emphasis on us individually moving towards something is really characteristically Buddhist, actually. So before I start off very kind of theoretical, in fact, I might not get very theoretical, I wanted to start off kind of personal in our approach to going for refuge. One of the things that I wrote down in my notes, it doesn't really kind of fit into the talk, but the early, in the Tiratnavandana, most of you know the Tiratnavandana, one of the descriptions of the Dharma is ehipassiko. And ehipassiko means come and see for yourself. Sometimes it gets translated, in our translation, it's translated as of the nature of a personal invitation. And the very early ordination ceremonies, when the Buddha himself was making somebody a bhikkhu, it was as simple as him touching somebody on the shoulder and just saying ehi bhikkhu. And ehi just means, again, basically come and see for yourself. So I think that very personal address of the Dharma, right from the beginning, people are asked to sort of taste it and to find out if it touches in you something that has meaning and something that has significance. So Viradama's little verse where he says, what does going for refuge mean to you in personal terms? In terms of your one precious individual life. I didn't ask Viradama, but I wasn't sure if he was quoting Tsongkhapa or Mary Oliver in that one precious individual life. So I'm going to read you both, actually. So at the end of one of Mary Oliver's poems called A Summer's Day, Mary Oliver says, I don't know exactly what a prayer is, but I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? And then she says, doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it that you plan to do with your one wild, precious life? Either she's been reading Tsongkhapa or Tsongkhapa has been reading Mary Oliver. Mm-hmm. But Tsongkhapa's verse is, the human form is one with difficulty. It's easy to lose. All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky. This life you must know as the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. Therefore, set your goal and make use of it every day and night to achieve it. So this little verse, it's one of the traditional sets of verses that turn the mind to the Dharma. So the sort of basic question, in a life that's a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being, what do you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And the answer to that is going to be an individual one, actually. So that the as I say, that the verses traditionally, the Buddhist answer to this is that question is best answered by going for refuge to Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But let me sort of come at that a little bit more gradually. I was in the Conversation Cafe this afternoon. Probably the most challenging table, I have to say, was the one out there in the garden where I had to fess up to my ethical shortcomings. But I was struck as well by the table where you had to give your favourite story of the Buddha. And I don't know what it was like in your table, but in my table, everybody came up with a different story for very, very different reasons. And you get this sense of what it is in the Dharma that people respond to. I'm not sure good reasons or bad, was Nagiya, who was one of the Buddha's attendants, wanting to go off and meditate in the mango grove. And I've always identified with Nagiya. I love it that Nagiya, having got the Buddha's advice, felt completely free to ignore it and go off and meditate, and will not spend the rest of his life in hell for disobeying the Buddha. Somehow I find that strangely reassuring. one of the other guys in my group was quoting the Buddha's going forth and, leaving the palace and the four sites that led up to that. And, there's that beautiful image of the going forth where the Buddha's holding up his top knot and about to cut it with a knife, and it sort of symbolises him leaving behind all of the kind of the ties that bind. But just really struck by the different metaphors, the different images that speak to different people. Sorry if I'm sort of labouring the point, but there's a famous story in the White Lotus Sutra called the Parable of the Burning House, which probably most of you are familiar with, but you get this little scene where there's a house on fire and the father wants to get the children out of the house, but the children are so caught up in playing that he can't get them out. So he asks them if they would like a cart, and asks them if they would like a cart, what kind of cart they would like. So the kids get all excited and they start imagining the kind of cart. One of them wants a cart pulled by a horse, one of them wants a cart pulled by a bullock. So the father says, okay, cart with a horse, cart with a bullock, whatever else kind of cart, it'll be out here waiting for you. So the kids get excited, run out of the burning house, and there's a cart that's more beautiful than any of them had asked for or any of them had imagined. But just like, again, that idea that something gets offered that fits the character of the practitioner, that something that's moving enough to touch us in a way that makes us leave the burning house and move into something where we're safe, where we're free. But different people respond to different things, different strands in the Dharma. And a lot of us are going to get a chance to do a wee life story, but I wanted just to mention my own situation when I first came along to Glasgow Buddhist Centre, which was once in Bath Street, which is one block away from Sucky Hall Street in the middle of Glasgow. This would be 1973, before most of you were born. And that I'd been doing the rounds in central Scotland. Right, I have to be saying, in central Scotland in the early 70s, there weren't that many spiritual options open once you had done the Church of Scotland and the Catholic Church. But whatever spiritual options there were, I had visited. So I'd been to the Baptists, I'd been to the Free Church of Scotland, I'd been to the Protestants, I'd been to the Catholics. Started to get more desperate. I'd been to the Baha'is. I'd ended up going to the Hare Krishnas. I don't know if you get the Moonies here still, but I even went to the Moonies.
They're still summer.
Yeah, so I survived a visit to the Moonies, but I went to everything that I could find in the early 70s in central Scotland. And nothing seemed to touch me. Ended up, just by circumstance, finding out about Buddhist meditation. Went along to Glasgow Buddhist Centre. And I'm sure my memory now sort of runs a number of different visits together. But in those days, there were very few concessions to popular taste. So you went in, you did a 45-minute meditation. You had an hour and a half lecture by Sangharakshita, and then you did an hour, a sevenfold puja and call and response. So my first night was mindfulness of breathing for 40 minutes, an hour and a half lecture on one of the stages of the Eightfold Path and then the Sevenfold Puja. So at the end of the evening, I was in a slight state of shock, I think. But just this sense of, this is what I've been looking for. And you get this sort of paradox, I think. Bante, in his biography, talks about when he was 16, hearing the Diamond Sutra, and realising that he was a Buddhist and always had been a Buddhist. I'll have to say that was not my response the first time I heard the Diamond Sutra. But there was something similar, actually. And I suppose I sort of wonder if this is true for many of you. It was this strange paradox of I was hearing something that was new. I was hearing something that I didn't know about, didn't know about the Eightfold Path. So on one level, it was brand new. And on another level, it was like, that's what I've always thought. I've never been able to articulate it. This is true. Just this sort of fundamental recognition of something that was true. Now, I was lucky, I think, that I got the Eightfold Path. I'm from a Church of Scotland background. I like my spiritual teaching sensible, and the Eightfold Path was this sort of beautifully articulated description of what the spiritual life was like, what the spiritual path was like. And I'd started off with the Christian churches because it was the background that I was familiar with, and I still remember in the Baptist coffee bar in Chapel Street in Hamilton, being told that what I had to do was to accept Jesus into my life. And actually, I was up for it. I was willing to give it a go, but I didn't know how to do it. Right? I remember one night lying in my bed, basically saying, Jesus, if you're ready, let's go. And for whatever reason, Jesus chose not to enter my life at that moment. And there was nothing I could do about it. You know, look, from my point of view, it was kind of heartfelt. But that I had no other tool available to me. Jesus did not enter my heart or my life. But listening to the Eightfold Path, I suppose, struck on the one hand by the depth of it. You know, like starting off with the whole perfect vision thing, so getting this description of the experience of enlightenment, but then just how grounded it was, you know, like going through from enlightenment to perfect emotion, from perfect emotion into action, just this idea that you act in a way that doesn't harm, you act in a way that doesn't take the not given, and so on. You go from there into communication, so the idea of communication that lets you tell the truth, that's more likely to create harmony than create division, that's likely to respond to somebody with kindness rather than harshness. Or just something about, on the one hand, the depth of it, and on the other hand, the absolute ordinariness of it and the kind of practicality of how you might practice. But I came away from that, I remember sometime in those first few weeks, literally running down Sutty Hall Street in excitement. Just, I was so excited. I'd found something that was what I'd been literally looking for years. And just wee bit eccentrically sort of battering down Sucky Hall Street with the excitement of it. But then you got this strange thing. I was sure that I had found what I was looking for. And I'd been looking pretty seriously. I was an angst-driven, you know, late teens, early 20s at that time. So this was life or death as far as I was concerned. And every, I think, Thursday evening, I would leave my apartment trying to get to the Buddhist centre. And sometimes I would get there. Right? And sometimes, inexplicably, I'd bump into somebody, we'd get talking, we'd go to the bar. So then I'd headed out for the Buddhist centre and I would end up in the bar, which seemed like a sort of good enough metaphor for different pools in my life. And I hope this isn't too sort of reductive, but this, I think, is what Banty's talking about when he talks about provisional going for refuge. You know, there's something where you really get a glimpse of something. You really see it. But you're not quite joined up enough to follow through. Sometimes you are. On a good week, you'll make it to the Buddhist centre. There's a real response. Other times, other drives, other things surface. You get pulled off in different directions. And for quite a lot of us, I think, for quite a lot of the time, our practice is starting to work with those different pulls in our own psyche. Anyway, I kept on going. A few years later, I was on a seminar called the Sigilavada Sutta. This was down at Padmaloka, where it was Sangharakshita. And I suppose the thing about a lot of these stories in the Pali canon is that, again, you get this sense of something personal being communicated. So the Sigilavada Sutta, that the setup is the Buddha's walking through a village, and he comes across this young householder called Sigala. And Sigala has been asked by his father every morning. His father's now dead. He's been asked by his father to worship the six directions. So he has to worship north, south, east, west, up and down. So every morning, religiously, Sigala gets up and does his devotions to the six directions. So the Buddha comes across him, asks him what he's doing. Sigala explains what he's doing. And the Buddha says, well, that's great, but you're doing it wrong. So Sigala's a little put out, and he says, what do you mean I'm doing it wrong? And the Buddha says, look, if you're going to worship the six directions, this is how you have to do it. And he goes into this whole network of relationships, and the east is family, and the west is friends, and the south is your employees, and the north is your teachers, up as your spiritual teachers, down as your children. And he completely enters the framework that Sigala was using, but takes it from being this sort of empty ritual into something that much more spiritually precisely gives Sigala something to work with in his life. You get this again and again with the Buddha. You get, you know, like he's talking to a farmer, he'll use the metaphors of a bull tied to a stake. You know, like the ox herding pictures, I guess, have got their roots in some of the Pali Canon stories when the Buddha's talking to farmers. He'll be talking to philosophers using the language of contemporary philosophy. Just that the Dharma always gets pitched to the life, to the concerns of the person that the Buddha's talking to. Padmavajra, I was listening to one of his talks about going for refuge, and he had this lovely, uses this lovely example of Supa Buddha, the leper. It's the Kuti Sutta from the Sutta Nipata. And Kuti means the leper. So this is a sutta about the leper. And Supa Buddha's route into the Dhamma was he was walking through the village, saw this big crowd, thought, crowd that size, somebody must be giving out food. So he's a beggar. He goes over looking for the food. There's no food. He's obviously disappointed. He thinks, I'm here anyway. The recluse Gautama teaching the Dharma. I might as well stay and hear the Dharma. So the Buddha gets a sense of Supa Buddha, and starts addressing the teaching directly to him. Basically runs through the threefold path, talks about the end of clinging, and Supa Buddha has this spontaneous arising of the fetters being broken. And, you know, just out of nowhere, you know, turning up looking for some food ends up as a stream entrant. But you get that sense all the time of the individuality of the teaching of the Buddha. But the way it gets reported in the Pali Suttas, it tends to be this little stock phrase of somebody going for refuge. So the response to this of Sigala's needs being met, of Sukha Buddha's needs being met, of the farmer's needs being met, of the Brahmin's needs being met, something's touched and there's this move towards, there's this response. And the way that the Pali Canon gives you this stock response is that the person touched says, "Magnificent Lord, magnificent." It's as if you have placed upright what was overturned, as if what has been hidden has been revealed, as if you have shown the way to someone who was lost, or have carried a lamp into the dark so that those with eyes can see forms. I go to the Blessed One for refuge, to the Dharma and to the community of monks. And I think it's interesting, you know, again, just wanting to sort of stick with this theme of how personal this is. You know, I don't know what your particular route into the Dharma is. I don't know what it is that touches you. But this set of metaphors, they're just so fundamental. Something that was overturned is upright. You can almost feel it in your belly. You get this sense of being lost, and suddenly there's a way clear. You've got this sense of being wandering in darkness, and then there's light. So just these basic metaphors of something that's out of kilter finding its place, something that's confusing, something that's dark becoming clear. So there's that very simple, visceral response in the Pali Canon all the time to the Buddha's teaching. And that, first of all, that moment of response, and then that move towards this, from now on, I go for refuge to the Blessed One, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. That move is the essential element, I think, in going for refuge. Something that matters to us deeply has been touched. You see it, like me going to the Eightfold Path lectures. There's a recognition and something that was dark is clear. A way that was lost has suddenly sort of opened up. There's a spontaneous, natural response coming out of what's most deeply important to us that seems to have been touched or been answered by what we've just heard. So Sangharakshita, talking about going for refuge, talks about it as the emotional and volitional aspect of the spiritual life. There's that first response, but not just a response. It's this sense of seeing something that you can take and start to live in your own life. You can actually start to embody in your own life. And one of the points that Sangharakshita makes, and again and again in his lectures, that Subhuti says when he's commenting on the lectures, is that move isn't something that you do just once. It's not that you go for refuge and you've gone for refuge. That the nature of spiritual practice, another metaphor from the Pali Canon, is that it slopes gradually like the ocean. So it starts off with this very simple step, you know, like for 40 minutes you're going to pay attention to the breath, or you're going to be a little bit more careful to respond to people kindly, that there's a first step into the depth, but it just gets gradually deeper and deeper and deeper. And that our decision to practice, you know, you gradually see more clearly where that path is headed. And at every step, there's another response, in a sense, another choice and another sort of move into something deeper. Going back to the sort of provisional going for refuge, verse in the Dhammapada, the anthology of verses from the Pali Canon, and the first two verses just lay out this basic spiritual choice. So first verse of the Dhammapada says that when you think and act with an impure mind, suffering follows, like the wheel of the cart follows the ox. When you think and act with a pure mind, happiness follows as closely as your own shadow. And again, without getting very theoretical about it, it's just this basic existential choice that we've got open to us. What's being said is, when you act out of awareness, it's different from acting out of confusion. Acting out of confusion, you're likely to act in ways that cause you pain. To the extent that you act out of awareness, you're likely to act in ways that have happy results. When you act in a way that's aversive, when you're pushing the world away, it's likely to have consequences that are painful. If you act out of kindness, it's likely to have consequences that are satisfying. If you act from a very tight, self-referential point of view, it's going to be painful. If you act in a way that's open, that's less clinging to your own interests, to your own needs, it starts to open things up a little bit. And I think basically what practice is learning that those two choices are true. You start to learn in your own experience what it's like when you act skillfully. You start to learn in your own experience what it's like when you act unskillfully. And over time, well, at least this was sort of true for me, more and more of one's energy starts to line up behind the intention to act skillfully, to act with awareness, to act out of kindness, to act out of less self-clinging. And one of Subbuti's papers, he says that when you feel that current towards awakening, that current towards more awareness, more kindness, when you feel that start to become the central volition, when you leave your apartment on the evening of the Dharma class and end up in the Buddhist centre rather than the bar, right, when it's consistent, when you can sustain it, that's the point of effective going for refuge. And I don't want to sort of be too reductive here, but I think basically what ordination is doing is it's just a marker. And it's a marker that in each of us, that current towards waking up, that current towards awareness, that sense that this is the thing that most satisfactorily touches what's most deeply important to us. When you get the sense that that move into awareness, into kindness, is the thing that touches us most deeply, when that's a sustained current in our lives, that's the point where going for refuge becomes effective. That there's enough understanding, enough of our own energy behind it, for it to be sustainable and for you to be confident that you're going to manage to sustain it. You've seen it clearly enough and seen it deeply enough that it's going to stay. So I was saying before that going for refuge isn't something that we do just once. And the later tradition started to draw out different aspects of what going for refuge meant. And again, you know, this is material that you've read, but I want to just sort of spend a little bit of time on some of those different aspects that different parts of the tradition have drawn out more explicitly. So the first one that Banti mentions in his writing about it is stream entry. So you've got this thing in the Pali texts in particular of stream entry. One of the things that Banti says about this is that stream entry is bringing out the cognitive and the permanent nature of going for refuge. So stream entry, traditionally, is when you break the first three fetters. And the first three fetters, the simplest reading of that that Banti gives is the fetter, like something that traps you, a fetter, something that traps you, something that holds you. The first one is the fetter of habit. It's just a way of seeing yourself, a way of identifying yourself that keeps you fixed. The second one's the fetter of doubt. So you can never quite commit yourself to a course of action. And the third one's the fetter of superficiality. So even where one of the traditional descriptions of this is dependence on rites and rituals as ends in themselves. So I want just to spend a minute on each of these. In the office, downstairs, the Aryaloka office, there's a little sticker on the notice board that says you don't have to believe everything you think. And I think a lot of the time we do. We believe what we think. We believe what we feel. You have these sort of transient mental states that we are completely caught in, we're completely sort of identified with, and they tend to run along the same habitual lines. You know, like, I don't know about you, but there are definitely states of mind that I'm pretty familiar with that my mind nicely, habitually will tend to run out. And what you're starting to do in practice is seeing that all of those mental states arise and pass. You're looking at a process, and a process that a lot of the time is kind of habitual. You start to take awareness into that process, and you get what in the Anapanasati Sutta is gradually, there's enough awareness around it. You get this traditional metaphor of the blue sky around the clouds. So more and more your awareness is less caught in the clouds, and it's starting to sort of relax back into that open space around it. The Pali Canon, or the Anapanasati Sutta, talks about it as viragati. And viragati means disentanglement. You're not so caught in these habitual, limited mental states. And in fact, you start to see that your consciousness isn't this tight, mechanical pattern that you're caught in. There's something much, much more spacious, much more open, much more creative than that. That's the kind of fundamental nature of the mind. And at some point that becomes a kind of clearer and clearer experience. And you move from this fetter, this sense of being caught, to this sense of openness, this sense of spaciousness around your experience. So the first fetter may be the breaking the self-view, breaking this habit, has got something of that flavour. Second one is doubt. And doubt is this sense of we don't quite engage with our life. I was reading Vajra Darshini, who's an order member. She's got a little blog about this. And she was saying for a long time she couldn't quite give herself the Dharma practice. She kept on having this question of, deep down, am I a Buddhist? And then she realised her reading of the Dharma was, she realised, deep down, you're not anything, actually. You are the result of the conditions that you create. So you're never going to discover if you're a Buddhist or if you're a Baptist or whatever. What Buddhism is saying is, to the extent that you act with awareness, you create a current in your experience that starts to become freer, starts to become clearer, starts to become more open. To the extent that you act out of confusion, you create pain. To the extent that you act kindly, you create a current in your mind that again opens you up, connects you to yourself, connects you to the people around about you. There's no essence in there. There's a flow of mental events. And if you set up particular conditions, you pay attention, you stop responding to yourself or to other people harshly, there's a consequence to that, a sequence of more and more clear, free mental states start to emerge from that. But it comes from the choice to engage with our experience, to start to set up those conditions, and the confidence that when you set up the conditions, certain consequences naturally follow from the nature of your mind. And the third one is dependence on rites and rituals as ends in themselves. Bhante talks about it in terms of superficiality. And just a very, very obvious thing. We go through the motions sometime when we're meditating. I remember this revelation when some of the meditation teachers at Vajraloka came to the LBC. And before we meditated, they made us just stop for a minute. Remember what we were doing. Remember that we were trying to pay attention to the breath. Get in touch with the emotional energy and make a definite decision to be attentive to the breath. And it was transformative. You know, it sounds almost sort of facile, but just reminding yourself what for the next 20 minutes or 40 minutes you're about to do, and to take real emotional engagement into that activity. And realising a lot of the time we go through the motions, you know, like what we're meditating, but we're not really meditating. Or half of our mind is writing a Dharma talk, for example. Or you're talking to somebody, but you're not really talking to somebody. Skype's a great thing, because Skype, you can see whether or not the other person's paying attention, or whether they're sort of like talking to my sister. My sister's usually typing up her notes while I'm on the line, for example. Just so often we go through the motions of an activity, and just this move into consciously engaging with what we're doing and actually living it as we do it. So Banty's translation of this is commitment. It's just this actual engagement with something. And I think another way it shows in meditation practice is people get dissatisfied with a method, and they think another method is going to be the helpful one. So you get people kind of, you spend a few months on this practice, and then a few months on that practice, and then you think maybe this practice will be more helpful. But really, it's the wrong question. It's not which practice. Another wee aphorism of Banty's is there are no higher teachings, there are only deeper understandings. And if you're working with something that supports a deepening awareness, or you're working with something that takes you into kindness, you're working with the absolute core elements of Dharma practice. If you can engage fully with something that supports awareness, you don't need to worry much about how fancy the method is. So just this idea of rather than engaging with practice or with anything else superficially, it's this conscious, open engagement with what our experience is, what our spiritual practice is. So that's stream entry. As Banty says, it's you see into those habits deeply enough, and you end up with something that's open, that's engaged, and that's got a sustained move towards deeper experience. So that's stream entry. Another one, I'll deal with this a little more briefly, but coming back to this image of going forth. In the Theravadin tradition, serious practice tended to be identified with monastic practice. So if the Theravadins are talking about this sort of central engagement with practice, one of the ways it would be talked about is the going forth. Again, this image of the Buddha leaving the palace. But Subhuti in the manifesto talks about what he calls sutra-style monasticism. And he's saying that there's something in that monastic lifestyle that we can learn from as practitioners. And he tries to sort of crystallise out what the really crucial elements of it are. Like, one of them is just this obvious one of simplicity and fewness of possessions. I'm standing up here feeling kind of confessional. I've just bought this very fancy coffee press that I've been playing with over in the annex, and I was playing with my new coffee press and writing this thing about simplicity and fewness of possessions, and just realising I might have a little more work to do in this area. But you get this lovely Ryokan in one of his poems talks about his possessions as one robe, one bowl. Right, and one robe, one bowl, it goes back to the Vinaya monastic ordination. What you're allowed to own is one robe, one bowl, some medicine, that's it, end of story. Kamala Sheila, one of our order members, has a nice update on that. He was homeless for a number of years and talked about his lifestyle as basically one robe, one bowl, one laptop, one iPad. But you want just the possessions that you need to be able to support your practice. So that's simplicity of possessions. Second thing is monastic life, probably one of our strongest associations with it, celibacy. This is not a celibate order. A couple of order members have suggested to Banty it would be more hardcore and committed if it was a celibate order. And Banty probably agreed, but said it would also probably be a smaller order if it was a celibate order. So it's not a celibate order, but there's a definite the Woody Allen joke. Sorry, it's one of the few jokes I know. It's better than that tomato joke, though, right? thing from Annie Hall. The guy goes to the psychiatrist and says, "My brother thinks he's a chicken." And the psychiatrist says, "Well, bring him in. We can help." And the guy says, "Yeah, but the problem is we need the eggs." Right, so and Woody Allen was using this as an example of the expectations that we bring to relationships that don't always get fulfilled. You need the eggs, you don't always get the eggs. Anyway, the idea that romantic relationships, like emotional relationships, for all of us are important. But I think the sort of the Buddhist position is they arise in dependence on conditions. Sometimes they're going to be deeply satisfying, sometimes they're going to be painful. If they're the central element in your psychological security, sometime down the line it's going to be painful. So it's how you have an intelligent, ethical, skillful, intimate relationship without making it central to your own psychological security. So somewhere on that spectrum between an intelligent intimacy and celibacy, there's perhaps sort of lessons to learn. And the last one is career. One of the big pulls in Western culture, one of the big pulls in American culture, it's very interesting coming here from Europe. You know, like in Europe, where most of the societies are communist and, you know, like we get holidays. We get like 6 weeks holidays would be standard, for example. And coming to the States, where a lot of people got a couple of weeks off work and you've got to make a decision about coming on retreat or, you know, what you're going to do with your 2 weeks. Work is a real shaping factor in our lives. And just the hope, I think, is to engage with your work in a way that's as simple as possible and that supports your practice. Again, this is not an imposition, right? This is not Buddhists outside saying if you want to be a good Buddhist, you have to cut down on the importance of work. It's actually the other way around. It's saying, what is it in your own experience that supports the experience of liberation? How far does the work that you do support that? What changes can you make? How can you engage with your work in a way that as far as possible supports your own move towards waking up? And it's so, you know, like I remember myself when I was, you know, briefly working in real jobs, you get caught up in it, you know, like it's tempting to go for a promotion, it's tempting to go for a wage rise, and without being very kind of conscious of whether or not it serves your values, you get kind of caught up in the momentum. At least I remember doing that myself. So, you know, can we simplify around work? I wanted just to mention a friend of mine I'm working with very closely, who just turned, I don't know, late 40s. She was a policy advisor on health policy for the Labour Party in Australia. High-powered, well-paid, lived in a nice part of Melbourne, which is a nice sunny city. And she's given up her work, given up her house, given up her apartment in Melbourne, moved to a wet part of West England to work for very, very little money indeed, because she feels it's a better expression of her own values. So again, just not recommending any particular outcome, but just that question, how do we simplify work so it supports practice? So going forth is this other aspect. And then finally, the arising of the bodhicitta. So that the Mahayana made this aspect of going for refuge, this aspect of engaging the practice, almost the central one. And just this very simple point to make here. So the arising of the bodhicitta is just recognising that practice, an intrinsic part of spiritual practice, is a move away from self-obsession. And was it some writer, I think it was Iris Murdoch, says love is acting as if other people are real. Mm-hmm. Just starting to recognise we're in a world where other people exist, and realising that any deepening spiritual experience is a deepening of kindness. a deepening of awareness of others, a deepening of responsiveness to others, and that when we practice, we don't just practice for ourselves, but we practice for self and other. And anything that doesn't have that flavour is still working within something self-referential, something egocentric. There's a practice that we do in the movement. We probably won't have time to do it on this retreat, but a practice called the Bodhicitta practice. And very simple, very kind of vivid practice. You sit down, and the first thing you do is just you're aware of your own experience. You're aware of your own experience that's pleasurable. You're aware of anything that's going on that's painful. So just this kind relationship to your experience as it is. And then you recognise that there's this basic drive to be happy and that we do things that cause us pain. And then you just reflect, wouldn't it be better if we didn't do the things that cause us pain and we make this decision to move towards what supports the happiness? And then you reflect on a friend, you reflect on what you appreciate about the friend, you reflect on the friend's painful experience. And just the same reflection, you've got this sense of the potential of the friend. You've got this sense of how they act in a way that hurts them. And you just reflect, as I am, so my friend is. And you're looking for that point of connection, just that point of sympathy, where you wish for yourself and for your friend that you're well and happy. And then you just broaden it out. As my friend feels, so all beings feel. All beings want to be happy. All beings do things that cause them suffering. There's a wee line in it just says, what a pity. And that the practice says you generate an unbearable longing for liberation. So the practice is just you connect to yourself, connect to your friend, connect to other people. Just reflect that all you want to be happy, all of you do, things that cause you suffering. What a liberation it would be to see that and to make the choice that supported the happiness for self and for others. And basically just that reflection, taking attention to the choice that you've got and looking for that move towards what liberates us is the going for refuge, not just for self, but for self and other. And last point I wanted to make is, in a sense, that's what joining the order is about. I think realising that you don't practice alone, that one of the things that your practice does is that actually it makes you more able to come into relationship. That you're a little more able to be aware of yourself. You know, you're aware of how you feel. You're aware of what's driving you. And similarly, you're a bit more aware of other people. You're just a little bit able to come out of a habitual bubble. They'd be a bit more attentive to another person, a bit more attentive to what's important to another person, and get a wee bit more of a sense of how you can respond in a way that sort of supports their own process of trying to wake up. And I think what you've got in the order is us and our process or struggle even of trying to wake up, coming into relationship with other people who are also struggling to wake up. And in that relationship, something becomes possible. I can be aware of, reflect back to you what it is that you're trying to do. You can be aware of, reflect back to me what it is that I'm trying to do. And there's a depth of connection that becomes possible out of two struggling awarenesses coming into connection with each other, coming into awareness of each other, coming into to contact with each other. And what the order is, I hope this is what the order is. It seems to me at the time I was writing it, at least, that it's this conscious commitment to each other to come into relationship in a way that supports this move towards awakening. And just us with a bit of kind of kindness, a bit of sensitivity, figuring out how can I relate to you in a way that's helpful? How can you relate to me in a way that's going to be helpful? And although the awareness works across the board, meeting somebody else who's involved in the same project to waken up, there's a certain depth of connection becomes possible in that relationship. So over the next 10 days, I hope we get a little bit of a taste, in the next 9 days, whatever it is, a little taste of what deepening going for refuge feels like. We're in a situation that's simplified, a situation where there are fewer distractions than there usually are, a situation where we're doing a bit more practice than usual, where we're relating to each other with a little bit more awareness, a little bit more kindness. We're trying to set up the conditions that give us a direct flavour of what it is in the Dharma that touches that deep need in us, that gives us a wee bit of an experience, I hope, that supports our deepening confidence in going for refuge.